At Pizza Nova, there's something for every pizza lover. Create your own masterpiece with some of our vegan or vegetarian options that include our dairy-free mozzarella, our gluten-free multigrain dough, and our gourmet vegetarian toppings. Ciao, I'm Dominic Primucci, and I invite you to taste the difference.
439-4444 Pizza Nova.
They're not afraid to put their name on it. This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
It is time for another Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 360. Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch. What are we looking at? Travis's computer froze, so we don't have our lineup yet. I do know that Big Daddy, Bob McGill, is going to join us at 2:25. Tim Turk will be along as well. He's a hockey skills coach. And something I thought about last night, and Sonny Sachdeva, who's a writer at Sportsnet, wrote an interesting article a couple of days ago on what happened to the slap shot? Why has it disappeared? And I thought about this last night as I watched several opportunities where both Leafs and Kings defensemen could have wound up for a slap shot, but instead they insisted on like going at the wrist shot. I remember when the slap shot was a big deal. I remember watching Bobby Hull, and I don't want to be that guy, but my God, when guys like Bobby Hull and Bernie Jeffrey wound up for slap shots, it was amazing. And it's gone. It's gone out of the game now for a variety of reasons. So Tim Turk, who's a skills coach that a lot of NHL players use and work with in the offseason, is going to join us. It's going to be a fascinating discussion because it is something I know. You sit up in the press box, you watch the game, Richard, and you're watching, like, come on, man, just crank it. And I understand that with positioning and everything now, and Mike Babcock made this point yesterday, with positioning and everything now, it's harder to get a clear lane to take your shot. And it takes a long time to wind up for a slap shot. So most people are making almost a judgment. You know, do I wind up? Do I take an extra bit of time to wind up and fire it into some guy's gut? Or do I take that time and maybe try to find another shooting angle? But we'll talk to Tim Turk about that. It's a fascinating discussion.
Yeah, no, I read that piece. I thought it was fantastic. I'd never thought about that before.
Oh, yeah, it's funny.
Such
you know
a
what?
Cool angle.
Well, and I was watching the Nationals. Got my baseball season's over, Jeff. The Capitals and Leafs game last week, and John Carlson let just an absolute howitzer go from the blue line. And I remember thinking, I can't remember the last time I saw that.
Yeah, the guy who, like, at least sort of when I was a little younger, really always stood out to me is Al McGinnis, when he would really crank one up
in the 90s,
or the 100s. But that piece, and I'm really looking forward to talking to Tim Turk, was just interesting and just, you know, sort of explaining why the slap shot has sort of gone away in the game, what value might it have right now. And then the Tim Turk part, which was really fascinating, was, can you teach it for the modern game?
Right.
And how do you, how do you sort of get ahead of the goalie and the defense on it? So I thought that was just a brilliant idea to do a piece on.
So we'll get Tim Turk on. Matt Devlin will join us. Yep. Raptors found out today they'll be without Patrick McCaw for a while. It looks like the first man up in terms of logging some additional minutes will be Terrence Davis. We'll see how that works out.
He's looked good so far about that. As a rookie.
To me. He's six games. He's been okay, but he's also not been asked to do what he's going to be asked to do now.
So. I guess I'm basing it on expectations, given that he wasn't like a top, wasn't a first round pick or anything versus performance. But yeah, I mean, now things change.
Yeah, yeah, that'll be, he'll have an extra load in his plate. We got to talk about, and Pete Caldera is going to join us.
Yeah.
At 4:25. Those of you who listen to my show and Baseball Central will know that Pete Caldera, he's covered the Yankees for the Bergen Record for years and years and years. He's also a singer. I wouldn't say he's a Sinatra impersonator because he could sing, but he does a Sinatra shtick, if you want to call it that. And in spring training, there's an Italian restaurant in Tampa where he will on Saturday nights go. He is the lounge act. And he was on Stephen Colbert on Monday. which is a pretty big deal.
Yeah.
For your, I'll ask him. It may not be his network debut singing, but we'll talk to him about that.
Would you use the word crooner? You like that word for him?
Yeah. Although he's, yeah. But he's got a great voice, okay. And he does sound like Sinatra.
Yeah,
talented. And he's got the whole Italian thing happening, right. Too. So, very suave and de boner, as we used to say. Suave and de boner. So Caldera will join us later on in the show. That'll be a lot of fun. Got to talk about last night's Leafs game. Leafs beat the Kings 3-1. I was talking before the show to Ryan Walsh, producer of Timothy. He produces a bunch of stuff around here. But the first period of last night's game, Richard, there was no whistle for the first 6 minutes and 39 seconds. Yeah. I've got it down here. You know what else is amazing? I was at the game last night. I wrote up my book, No Whistles, / or Action. Nothing happened in the first 6 minutes and 39 seconds of the game last night. Nobody got hit. There were no great opportunities to score. It was, without question, the most boring first period of hockey. Now, admittedly, I don't watch hockey as much as I used to. The most boring first period of hockey I've seen in a long time. There was literally until Jeff Carter hit Alex Kerfoot. There was nothing going on. I mean, there was, and Walsh and I were talking about this. Think back, if you told someone like, I don't know, 10 years ago, you know what? There was no whistle 15 years ago. There was no whistle for the first almost 7 minutes of the game. You'd go, my God, guys flying back and forth, lots of shots, some missed the net, great saves, a couple of guys belted into the boards, all this great stuff, end to end. This was maybe the most meaningless end-to-end hockey I have seen in my life. Like, nothing was accomplished. You know what it was like? It was like watching two soccer teams park the bus and hoof the ball down the field and basically hoof it back and hoof it down and hoof it back, except, of course, the players were skating and moving the puck. Nothing happened.
Looked like a...
Oh, God, it was awful.
Like a scrimmage with, everybody wearing red shirts.
No, it was... You know what? If you were a coach and your team scrimmaged like that, you'd blow a whistle and you'd say, guys, get your asses in gear.
Yeah,
make something happen.
I will say, as you were there, I watched on TV. It's a very odd experience to go that long with no commercial breaks, but yet nothing happening.
Yes.
Which is just, I mean, that was a odd first period. I forgot who was broadcasting, but the broadcaster was talking about, well, at least you could sort of get some kind of fluidity with your lines, no stoppage in play, no matchups or anything like that. But I got to be honest with you, Jeff, that game itself was just an odd game to me. I mean, not a lot of hitting. The execution for the Maple Leafs until late in the game was pretty poor.
Right.
I mean, you take the win, obviously, because you get 2 points, but, I hate to use the cliche, but it's sort of like the definition of winning ugly. Although From the comments I read, and if you were there, it seems like Mike Babcock enjoyed
the
struggle, so to speak.
Well, Mike Babcock's perfect game is 1-0 where he wins.
That's
and
true.
The other team gets no shots.
That's
in goal.
Right. That's
so,
right.
So, I mean, I guess. Here's the thing.
Do you feel
better
about the Leafs after that game?
Oh, God, no. I don't. Yeah. But I don't base anything on one game.
No, I agree.
Yeah, you can't. I mean, I don't feel any better or any worse about the Leafs after one game. This is the start of a period of time where we are apparently going to, be able to judge the Leafs, see what they're about. Zach Hyman's going to come back, all that good stuff. So it was kind of the first game where most of their guys were back, where Travis Dermott was there and John Tavares was there.
Any chatter that you heard in the press box about Nick Batan, and was that just a...
Was that a
one-game look for the scouts?
Well, we'll talk to Bob McGill about that. I don't know if that happens anymore because everybody sees somebody in video.
Yeah.
Like, you know what Nick Batan is.
That's my fault, too.
Now, the fact that you were playing Nick Batan on a talented line with Marner and Tavares, I mean, clearly you're showing that he can keep up with the play, or you want to show that he can keep up with the play, and this team does have some decisions to make.
Right.
And it's pretty clear that there are at least two players on this team right now, or two players who are with the Leafs right now, who aren't going to be there. I think Nick Shore has shown enough that he deserves to stay up here. I'm a big fan of Travis Moore. I don't see him going anywhere. So I think it comes down to, you know, Nick Petan, Jason Spezza. And I would always err on the side of Jason Spezza. But again, Nick Petan got a full game pretty much playing alongside Marner and Tavares. And it wasn't great, but he was noticeable. And he certainly didn't. He was certainly able to keep up with them. So we'll talk to Bob McGill about that as well. But yeah, clearly this team has to make some decisions. They're in a situation now where they're using long-term LTIR, and that's going to end when Hyman comes back in the lineup. Right. And they're going to have to do that. And then I think, as Elliot Friedman said yesterday, Richard, you know, at some point we're going to have a come to Jesus moment about the backup goaltending.
Yeah, here. You know, Jeff, I think about this. It must be very frustrating for certain players who can dominate the AHL, but then get up to the NHL and can't necessarily seem to crack a lineup regularly.
He was only down there for.
No, but I'm saying, I'm not necessarily using Nick Petan, but there's a lot of guys who are sort of, what do they call it in baseball? Like
4A guys.
4A, yeah. You know, there are guys in every sport who are kind of 4A. And I don't know if Nick Petan will be that 4A player, but. That has to be rough. That has to be rough to sort of be on that shuttle between the AHL and the NHL.
You get decent money when you're in the NHL, and you do get some meal money. But it will give him a chance. If nothing else, he was given a good chance, or scouts that were there were given a good chance to see him. The next game for the Leafs, by the way, will be on Sportsnet 590, the fan of Sportsnet Ontario. That'll be Thursday night. The Golden Knights will be in town.
A real test.
Puck drop is just after 7. Leafs Nation postgame with Elberg and Stelic right after the final horn. Hockey Central Maple Leafs pregame at 6:30 p.m. on Sportsnet Ontario. Ontario area. Spit it out, Jeff. We mentioned tonight that the Sacramento Kings will take on the Toronto Raptors tonight. That game will be on Sportsnet 590. The fan of Sportsnet 1. Tip-off is just after 7:30. The Raptors have just sent out a press release regarding Patrick McCaw. And as soon as I can find this, I will read it. Here we go. Bunk, bunk, bunk. This is from the Toronto Raptors. After a short period of experiencing discomfort in his left knee, Patrick McCaw underwent arthroscopic surgery Wednesday to determine and correct the issue. A benign mass on the back of the knee was removed. The procedure is performed by Dr. Riley Williams at Hospital for Special Surgery in New York. A timetable for his return has not been established. He'll be reevaluated in 4 weeks, and his condition will be updated as appropriate. So you're looking 4 weeks at least before he's going to be able to get back and doing anything. Yeah. So as we said, this is a team that was already looking for sort of that third ball handler, somebody who can take some of the pressure, some of the workload off Fred VanVleet. And off Kyle Lowry, Patrick McCaw was the guy who was destined to get some of that. We've heard Pascal Siakam may get a chance to do that as well, may get a chance to add that to his game or use it in a more regular basis. But it looks tonight as if Terrence Davis will be the first guy out of there. It's pretty clear, I think, and Devlin will join us at 3:00, but it's pretty clear that it's not an ideal situation for the Raptors. This is what a lot of this year is going to be about because of the turnover last year. This is what a lot of this year is going to be about. So it will be interesting to see who Masai Ujiri ends up bringing in here. But I will say this. If I'm the Raptors, I'm going to take my time doing this because you're playing with house money this year. You're going to make the playoffs. Let's see if Terrence Davis can do it. Let's see if he can. If he does, hey, you know, What has happened with this team? We've seen guys like Fred VanVleet, undrafted player, come up and get a vote from Hubie Brown in the championship series. I mean, we've seen Pascal Siakam, what, a 29th pick overall, 27th, 29th pick overall, sign a max deal. The Raptors have done okay with guys we haven't expected much of. So let's give Terrence Davis a chance to run with this and let's see where it goes.
Yeah, the one thing that this organization, I think, Jeff, has done really, really well is development. Taking guys who are drafted in slots that are not traditional star slots, lottery spots, and really developing their game. Obviously, in Siakam's case, becoming an all-star. VanVleet's case, easy for me to say, you know, an incredibly productive player. The one thing about Patrick McCaw that is kind of a bummer to me is I don't think we in Toronto have seen his best at all. He, at his best in Golden State, was a really, really impactful defensive player. He's long. He gets in the passing lanes. He's just very active defensively, has some handle in terms of being a point guard. Offensively, a little bit challenged, but we haven't really, you know, we haven't come close to seeing what he could be. And that, you know, that to me, that's an injury that's a bit of a bummer because you do need perimeter depth. And like you said now, whether it's Terrence Davis, I think clearly Stanley Johnson and Rondae Hollis-Jefferson have to get more minutes because McCaw's not there. But, you know, we're going to find out about some of these guys that Nick Nurse sort of, to me, questioned in the preseason. We're going to find out a lot in the next month whether they can be rotation players or, you know, whether we're not going to see them come crunch time in the postseason.
There's another little story that kind of got our attention as well. We were led to believe, or Doc Rivers certainly suggested that load management was not going to be an issue for Kawhi Leonard this year. Kawhi Leonard is not starting tonight against the Milwaukee Bucks. And, of course, the, you know, the predictable reaction. This will be the second national game in which he hasn't played. We're going to deal with this later on in the show, but Richard and I got some thoughts on this. And you may not necessarily like them because I've got to say it. I tend to agree with Richard in this.
Wow, really?
Oh. There's a little disagreement here in that I'm not a fan of sitting your star players at home. I don't give a rat's ass if the game is on national TV. That's irrelevant. You didn't plan the TV schedule. That's on the networks. I have no problem with coaches sitting star players in network games. I just don't. But I got a problem with coaches sitting star players at home against the Milwaukee Bucks. I think that's stupid. I think that's flat out
strategically stupid. Like because
it insults your fans. I don't care about the TV folks. To be honest, right. I'm not going to insult my fans. How many people do you think paid money to come and see Giannis against Kawhi Leonard?
A lot.
Clippers fans. These aren't Lakers fans. These are Clippers fans. They're getting screwed as a result of that. Anyhow, we'll talk about that later. Yeah. We'll deal with that later on. When we come back, Bob McGill, Leafs Nation Network analyst, will join us. We'll talk about last night's game. A couple of instances, again, where the Leafs had their players, where opposing players, took some runs at Leafs players. Nothing, nada, zip, squat, jack, in the way of a response from the Toronto Maple Leafs. We'll talk to Bob McGill about that. And I'll ask Bob McGill something that I also realized last night as I was watching the Leafs. Is it just me or has Justin Hall been this team's best defenseman this year on balance? We'll talk to Bob about that. Big Daddy joins us. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Yo, I'll tell you what I want, what I really, really want. So tell me what you want, what you really, really want.
Now, this is what
I'm
talking about. We're doing our week of guilty pleasures on Writer's Block. It's Jen Rolnick's turn, and she's hit it out of the park right away. This was actually, Jen, for those of you, we're playing Spice World, playing Spice Girls right now. And this would have been on my list, but Jen, you served
it. You would have had the Spice Girls.
I love the Spice Girls.
Well, you're like, you're such a...
I'm not a metrosexual.
A London
I am a
lover.
London, yes. I love the
Anglophile,
Spice Girls.
That's what I was thinking.
I love the Spice Girls. They're so much fun.
I will say, I'm not sure how much I love the Spice Girls, but I do love the tabloid drama.
I'm talking about
the Spice Girls.
The pure singing skill.
Well,
the
you know,
pure songwriting, the joy of the songwriting.
That's in my attitude. They're all talented women, for sure.
Even though I don't know if they actually wrote their stuff.
That's a lot of
Jen strong out of the gate, though, wouldn't you agree? With guilty
that's
pleasures,
good.
this is like the bar has been raised.
Now I'm curious to see what Jen's got next.
The bar has been raised. There's no doubt about it. I think I'm doing tomorrow. And then Derek Brandeo, our technical. He's going to clean up. We're bringing him in. He's a guy I trust with all the music.
What are you going to bring up? Kansas?
Kansas? See, that's not a guilty pleasure.
It would be for me. The Outlaws?
Who are the Outlaws?
That's another like random 70s American country band.
No, I got most of my guilty pleasures are hair bands like Cinderella and
Cinderella
Choir Boys. Well, they're not really hair bands. But I got some. I've got a couple of surprises in there. I was going to put Donovan, hurdy-gurdy man, but that's really reaching. The Leafs beat the Kings 3-1 last night. They take on the Golden Knights on Thursday. And we'll have the game on Sportsnet 590, the Fan and Sportsnet Ontario. Bob McGill's Leafs Nation Network Leafs analyst. He joins us on Writer's Block. Mr. McGill, good of you to join us. I made the point before you came on that for a game that didn't have a whistle until 6 minutes and 40 seconds had elapsed, there was not a lot happening in those 6 minutes and 40 seconds, was there? I'm being polite, I think.
Well, yeah, you're right. It seems more and more there's games like that around the National Hockey League when you tune in nightly it's some overcoaching where both teams are trying to clog everything up and nothing seems to happen, including whistles. But at the end of the day, the Toronto Maple Leafs come up with a victory when they needed it to get kick off this three-game homestand, Jeff.
Oh, there's no doubt that, I mean, Mike Babcock will speak and coach speak a lot of the time, but I saw what he was getting at yesterday when he said, it wasn't a pretty game, but it was a game you like to win. I mean, it's a lot better to win that game 3-1 than lose 3-1. Believe me, it's a lot better.
Without question. And, it's something that, when you look at this club, they've had a hard time getting on track. And, you go back a week or two, Jake Muzzin called out the team after a loss, and Austin Matthews did the same thing. And then it was kind of like, okay, guys, let me stop the talking. Let's start to prove it. And, they played Washington. I thought they played pretty well, even though they lost in overtime. They win that marathon shootout game on Saturday against the Flyers. And then you come into the game against the Kings, who had, given up, 23 goals in their last five games. So, sometimes you get fooled into thinking, oh, boy, we're going to have a night here tonight where we can flash our skill and we're going to go out there and light it up. And the Kings, obviously, are a proud group, and they're trying to get things going as Todd McClellan, is instilling the defensive work there. So they made it hard on the Maple Leafs, and as a result, a bit of an ugly game. But they have to learn to win games like that. And I think that as the season goes along, you've got to find every different way in which you're going to win. But at the bottom line is that you get a victory, and now two in a row, and now you're looking for three come Thursday night against Vegas, which is going to be a tough assignment because they got a very good hockey club as well.
Bob, I want to ask you about adjustments. When you look at the D this year, one, what do you see? And two, if I could give you the power to do it, what would you change?
I didn't hear the first part, Richard. Sorry.
I said I want to ask you a question about the defense this year. Oh. So first off, one, what do you see? What's your evaluation of the group as a whole? And secondly, if I gave you the ability to change some combinations up, what would you do?
Well, so far, I think obviously, they've got a bunch of new guys. They've got three out of the six defense are different from last year. On a regular basis. I mean, Justin Hall, has only played 11 games all year last year. And to me, I think he's played tremendous, but I think they're starting to feel their way around. And I mean, to me, Tyson Barrie is the guy that I've just been a little bit surprised that I haven't seen more offensive flash out of him. He's shown that, him and Muzzin can play together and defend a little bit, no question. But I'm surprised that he hasn't been more offensive. Cody Ceci, I saw it coming in, playing with Morgan Riley, was going to have a bounce back for him because, I've played on bad teams too, and it's never fun and easy to play on a bad team as he did in Ottawa last year. And I think that he's starting to get his confidence back and has played pretty well. I think that those are your three pairs, and I think they're going to stick with them because I like the offensive and defensive side in each pairing. And, 15 games in, they sit, three games over 500 now. And I think that they're starting to feel like they're getting better as they progress along.
Bob, you mentioned Justin Hall, and you know, I made the point that I think maybe from the start of the year to now, look, Morgan Riley is, I think, the best defenseman in this team. That goes without saying. But from the start of the season to now, I think Justin Hall in some ways has been one of their most consistent defensemen. I know you've seen this guy a lot. You've seen him with the Marlies. Obviously, you've seen him now. What is he, and what is his ceiling exactly?
Well, Jeff, I'm glad to see that you feel that way, because I got lots of time for Justin Hall. And obviously, you know, see him come into the Maple Leaf organization on an AHL contract a couple years ago and ends up, you know, getting an NHL deal. And then what he went through last year, obviously, it's a big learning curve jumping to the NHL. But only playing 11 games coming, I thought, boy, is he going to get a chance this year? And he worked so hard this past summer, and he came into camp and you know, his size at 6'3" and his reach, I think, sets him apart from some different players. But it's his skating ability, and he gets around the ice so well. And he came into camp, and I thought right from the get-go in his first exhibition game, it was like, holy cow, Justin Hall played a great game. And then it just snowballed from there. He's got confidence right now, Jeff, and, you know, it's the most used word in sport, but it's the most important word in sport. And Justin Hall has got the confidence of the coaching staff now, but more importantly in himself, knowing that he can get out there and just play. And I think him and Dermott together form that third pairing that is outstanding for this hockey club.
Bob, what'd you make of Nick Batan playing with the big line last night?
You know, I thought Nick played okay. And, you know, it's difficult because he's, you know, that word of confidence, right? And, you know, you're in and out of the lineup. You play on the fourth line. You play on a third line. You're having a hard time, you know, with the fact that, boy, if I don't play well, I'm gonna be out of the lineup again. And that's a really difficult thing for a player. And, you know, he got sent down to the minors last week. He had a two-goal, two-assist night in Belleville last Friday. He had another assist on Saturday in Laval. And, you know, he gets recalled and then thrown on that line. Well, you'd think that he's going to have lots of confidence. I thought he played okay. And, again, just trying to get back up to the speed of the NHL. And, you know, it's one of those situations where, you know, when you think of Hyman coming back in the very near future here, there's going to be some deletions to this hockey club. And I would think that they're maybe going to see if they can try and, you know, work out something that Nick Batan can stay in the National Hockey League. Whether it's a move to another team or not, it remains to be seen. But, you know, he's a good kid, but it's a difficult situation, because where do you put him on this team when you've got a full complement of players, because they've got so much skill and he's one of those kind of players.
Yeah, I found it interesting. In some ways, it's similar to Josh Levo, although they're different players in that I think Josh Levo last year gave the Leafs something that they didn't have in terms of his size and you know, a little bit of aggressiveness. But it was interesting watching that line combination, Bob, because my thinking is, you know, if you're scouting that game or, you know, whatever, you're watching it in videotape, you're at least seeing that Nick Batan can keep up with the pace of that line, right? The one thing that stood out to me is he wasn't a trailer in a lot of those plays with Tavares and Marner. He had no problem keeping up with them.
Oh, without question, Jeff. And I mean, you know, he's a skilled kid, and you know, he's just never gotten an opportunity at the NHL level to, you know, say, okay, we're going to give you 10 games with John Tavares and Mitch Marner. And, you know, he didn't get that in Winnipeg and certainly not here as well, to be able to sort of maybe get that confidence in his game to establish that ability to be that offensive player in the National Hockey League, because he hasn't been able to do that, whereas he has in the past in the American Hockey League.
Now, Bob, I know this is something that you've talked about a lot. A lot of people around the team have talked about this. But last night we saw Jeff Carter nail Alex Kerfoot. He had to leave the game briefly, came back. We saw Tyler Toffoli hammer Travis Dermott. Hammering was practically a body slam. It looked like it was WWE. There was nothing much in the way of a response. Now, look, I know the Leafs' philosophy is, we're going to get back at you by scoring on the power play. That works when you do score in the power play. But, Bob, at some point, regardless of how this game is going, at some point somebody has to step in here, don't they? And I mean, I hate to say it, somebody has to step in and lay a licking on somebody.
Well, you know me, Jeff, and the way I played, it's a little hard for me to watch sometimes. But welcome to the new NHL, right? Mm-hmm. It's something where. When you look at the success of the last two Stanley Cup winners in St. Louis Blues and the Washington Capitals, big, heavy teams, physical, and the grind of the playoffs, obviously, is something where you've got to have some guys that can step up and get dirty. And, who's going to step up and do that with the Maple Leafs? I don't know for sure, but it is something where I would like to see that if somebody's taking advantage, one of your teammates, that somebody steps in and does something. If you win the fight, it's to show up and show your teammates that you're going to stick up for each other. And I'd like to see a little bit more of that. I don't think there's any question about that.
Bob, when would you play Michael Hutchinson next, looking at the schedule?
Well, I mean, you've got the back-to-back this weekend, and, the Philadelphia Flyers come here Saturday, and then they're Sunday night in Chicago, so he's going to play one of those two. Which one is he going to get? I don't know. Richard, it's one of those things where, there's sometimes maybe I would look at the fact that, hey, you're playing at home, and it's the first night of a back-to-back, and you're going to have... Frederick Anderson played last night. He's going to play tomorrow. Does he play again Saturday, or do you wait, give him an extra day and let him be fresh on Sunday when they're in a back-to-back? And Chicago plays on Saturday night as well in Pittsburgh. So both teams are not going to be at their best. So maybe it's a situation where we see Hutchinson get the start on Saturday night, but I'm going to lean towards the way Mike Babcock has always approached the fact is get your win with your top goalie in your first of back-to-back. So I would expect that it'll stay the same as what we've seen in the first four times they've had back-to-backs this year.
Yeah, I think you are right. I think that is what is going to happen, Bob. But I would flip it on this Saturday for exactly some of the reasons you mentioned.
Well, yeah, I don't disagree. I mean, there's been a couple times, where... The time where they had the Boston game on the second night, and you had I think it was Minnesota coming in the day before, and they had played the day before as well. They lean on the analytics of how that works so much in today's game, but I'm in the boat of. The way Frederick Anderson's playing right now, he gets an extra day in between playing three times this week. I would be leaning towards maybe seeing Hutchinson on home ice as well to give him an opportunity to win a game himself so that he can get some confidence in his game.
Bob, we're going to let you scoot. Always good to talk to you. Thanks for doing this, man.
You betcha, gentlemen. Have a great day.
Thanks, Bob.
Absolutely. Bob McGill, Big Daddy McGill, as he's known on Twitter. And yeah, Big Daddy, like I said, it's fun watching a hockey game next to him. I swear to God, last night I thought he wanted to jump out, put the blades on and go out and beat Jeff Carter.
Give somebody a...
Well, he's a just... He, look, we know where hockey's gone. And I like the game now. I really enjoy the game now. I was not one of those people that really got excited with fighting in hockey because... A lot of the time, not much was accomplished. It was two guys grabbing onto each other, and, they'd play organ music, and the crowd would go nuts. And nothing really much would happen. Guys would hold each other and fall to the ice. And that's without even thinking about what damage was done when guys actually land punches. To me, it was just, it was a waste of time, a waste of energy. But I'm also a big believer that there's nothing wrong with a body check. And there are two things a body check can accomplish. The first thing body check does is it separates man from puck. That's absolutely the most important thing. The other thing it does, though, is it exacts a physical toll on your opponent. Nobody likes getting hit a great deal. It makes you uncomfortable. It gets you hurt. And what I saw last night, especially Jeff Carter, who basically ran around with impunity, during the game. Had a couple of really good shifts, and that's Jeff Carter. Hey, that's Jeff Carter's game. I'm not complaining about what Jeff Carter was doing. That's the way he plays. But at some point, somebody needed to respond, and we don't see it with this team. Zach Hyman has a little bit of that, but he's not to the point where you're going to, you know, to expect him to be the guy who steps in and sorts things out. Frederick Gauthier is big enough. He doesn't seem to have the inclination to do it. You know, Jake Muzzin.
A little bit, but still.
But still. And that's.
I think you just. You
there's hit, a balance there.
You hit on something to me that's important. If you're the way the roster and the way the team is sort of set up, you have to make opponents pay on the power play. And if you don't, then you really don't have any hammer, Jeff, because like you said.
Well, it's fine to make them play in the pay in the power play, but sometimes that's not enough. Sometimes you've got to.
No, I understand.
Frankly, sometimes you got to take a piece out of the guy who's taking a piece out of your players.
They don't really have that player.
Because I'll tell you what, Tyler Toffoli got a penalty for roughing, and Travis Dermott didn't change the way the Kings played. Okay. They went back out there and played the same way. So it's just something that, it's great to say we're going to make you pay on the power play, but there's nothing wrong with one out of every four opportunities hammering the hell out of somebody and then taking care of business on the next power play. We mentioned that the Bucks and the Clippers will play tonight. That game will be at 10 p.m. on Sportsnet 1. Kawhi Leonard will not be playing for the Clippers. And this is, you know, what is it, 3 years now that we've talked about load management and players sitting out games. And it's not just in the old days. See, things are different. In the old, not even the old days, 5 years ago, you would have a guy in uniform and just have him sit in the bench. He's just not playing. Now the thing to do is give a guy a real day off. You leave him in street clothes, maybe have him go and work out with your physio, with your sports science department. But there's kind of an out of sight, out of mind thing. And you see it as well in baseball. John Gibbons used to say, when I give Russ Martin a day off, it's a day off. I don't want to have to use him. If we're going to play a 24-inning game, there's a chance he may have to come in. But I don't even want him on the bench. I don't want to look down there and think, God, I wonder if I should put Martin in now. A day off is a day off. I have nothing, I see nothing wrong with it. I don't like an aspect of the fact that Bucks or the Clippers are sitting out Kawhi Leonard tonight. It has nothing to do with the fact we're carrying the game. There's something else about it I don't like. I know Deitch doesn't necessarily agree with me, but we'll talk about it. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
So I'm told by a spy that Victoria Beckham is actually in town. She's going to make an appearance on Breakfast TV tomorrow. That's from Jen Rolnick as well, who knows all things Spice Girl. So Victoria Beckham, if you're listening, one, I have your husband's Manchester United jersey. Two, I have a vinyl copy of Spice World. And three, you've got an invitation to come on the Writer's Block.
Ugh, you're so great.
If you're not doing anything.
How great would be if she was on the round table?
She'd be on tomorrow.
No, I know what I'm saying. General.
If you're watching us on TV, I mean, a couple of things. One, this week we're playing all our guilty pleasures. So folks can hear it in the radio. They're not hearing it in TV. So you just have to trust me that it's very good. And what you're really going to do is go to the podcast to find out the music that we're playing. Secondly, you've probably noticed that there have been a whole whack of kids walking behind us, including one young lad who insisted on flexing, doing his best Kevin Barker impression. It is Bring Your Kids to Work Day, and several people have taken up the offer. So if you see more activity than like them, wave.
Wave. Wave, ladies.
Wave. There.
There you go.
If you see kids waving at us, that's...
Or just waving.
Bring your kids.
Not necessarily at us.
Yeah. Bring your kids to work.
There's a lot of them.
It's a great idea. Eh? Yeah, they put on... They
a lot of these scams floating around.
They have... That's not a scam. It's a great thing. They have food, and they get a tour of the things here, and they get a pep talk from everybody.
That's cool.
They don't let me do it because my pep talk usually begins with
get out of the business, yeah, kids.
You look like such bright young kids. I've got two words of advice for you: law school. It's an old line I've used, and I know that I'm going to get people on Twitter are going to hammer me for it because there are.
Yeah, law school's not exactly always the greatest advice these days either, given the debt you will incur.
Well, there's chances of making it up, though.
Yeah, that's the one thing about an MBA or law school is
everybody needs lawyers because people are always screwing up.
Yeah, or screwing over someone. But I mean, yeah,
at some point they're going to have monkeys doing this. Or robots.
You do have the ability to eventually land a high paying job to pay your loans. But Jeff, at least in the States, there's a glut of lawyers, and a lot of people have taken massive debt and are not getting those big white shoe jobs anymore.
We got 4 minutes left.
All right, let's do it.
The LA Clippers have decided that Kawhi Leonard will not play tonight for load management.
I applaud him.
It is a second national game he will skip. Mr. Deitch is fully in favor of this.
Sit him out the whole year.
Because he's heartless and soulless. And now that I know that we're carrying the game, I think it's the worst thing any team can ever do. I think Doc Rivers should be ashamed of himself. If I was Adam Silver, I would levy a heavy fine on Doc Rivers.
Ballmer will just pay.
All kidding aside, I have said this, and I said it with Kawhi Leonard last year. There were people, including some in this station, who made a habit of ripping load management. Well, guess what? It worked out. They won a title. Load management is a thing. I believe in it implicitly. But I don't like leaving your star players out during home games. It's one thing to thumb your nose at the TV audience. It's another thing, as the Clippers are doing tonight, to do it when you're at home against Giannis and the Bucks. That is like sitting Vladdy Jr. on a long weekend Monday multiplied by a billion. Like, there is no conceivable reason that Kawhi Leonard shouldn't be playing tonight and starting. Considering the fact that I got to think it's a pretty good ticket, and I got to think a lot of people who look at the team's schedule at the start of the year, not everybody can afford to buy season tickets. Say, you know what, I'm going to go to 3 games this year. One of those games you'd probably want to go and see was Giannis and the Bucks. So I think this is embarrassing, frankly.
All right, so quickly, Jeff, I say big boo-hoo to ESPN or Turner or any ESPN or Turner employee who's complaining about this. Your network pays a lot of money for those games. That was your network's choice, and I have absolutely zero sympathy for a television network here. Boo-hoo. Secondly, I do feel, and I do have sympathy for those who bought tickets.
Except for this television network, which is showing the game. Concerned about the
impact. I am concerned about this, okay, of course. Thank you. Yeah. If you bought a ticket for the game, I totally understand you'd be disappointed that Kawhi is not going to be there. But the reality of the situation is, Jeff, and this is where we, I think, both agree, the Clippers' job, Clippers management, Clippers medical, Clippers coaching staff's job is to win an NBA championship and to do that as best they can. And
November 6th.
Jeff, if they have determined that Kawhi Leonard should play a certain amount of games, which
play
they
tonight,
clearly
take
have.
Take the next game off.
No. Load manage, however the schedule is, and if it turns out to be a high-profile game, that is just the breaks. Caveat emptor. If you are a fan, you...
That's spoken like somebody who doesn't pay to see teams play.
Jeff, I sympathize with those who are not going to see Kawhi tonight. At the end of the day, Kawhi Leonard has to do what's best for his health. The Los Angeles Clippers have to do what is best for them to win a title. And I would then argue larger that I want these guys healthy.
That's embarrassing.
And at their best in the playoffs.
That's awful.
When it matters most for fans and for teams.
Take a road game off. It's not poor Kawhi.
I wish you took a road game off, but you know what?
Kawhi's not going to break down by playing tonight.
If the schedule says tonight's the load management game, tonight's the load management game.
That's rubbish.
Not at all, Jeff. You know what? Then all I would say to the people is don't complain in the playoffs if Kawhi breaks down. Okay? Like, because you wanted him to play November 10th.
Oh, come on. So he's going to break down on November 6th?
Jeff,
because
it was proven last year. 68 games for this guy or whatever it is.
Well, then take games off on the road. That's what I'm saying. It's easy to do. They you know, the schedule does come out. They do know who they're going to be playing down the road.
I get it.
Anyhow. And we're never going to agree with this.
I know.
I'm always right. Matt Devlin, Raptors play. I'm just kidding. Matt Devlin. No, I'm not. Matt Devlin's next. It's Writer's Block.
They're rewriting afternoon sports radio, one word at a time. This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Toronto FC will take on Seattle in the MLS Cup next week, next Wednesday. Quentin Westberg, Toronto FC's keeper, one of the heroes of their Eastern Final win over Atlanta United, will join us at 3:25. In other words, about 25 minutes from now. We mentioned that the Raptors will take on the Sacramento Kings tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 1. Pre-game show will be at 7 p.m. Tip-off will be just after 7:30. Eric and Paul will have the call on the radio. Matt, Leo, Brad, Michael, and Danielle Michaud will handle the TV side of things. Matt Devlin now joining Richard Deitch and myself in Writer's Block. Mr. Devlin, thank you very much for doing this today. We know now that Patrick McCaw has had surgery, that he will be reevaluated in 4 weeks. The question in this city, obviously, now is this was a team that was, I would say, a little thin of ball handlers to begin with. How does this impact that thinness? Terrence Davis, we're led to believe, gets first crack at this. How do you see Nick Nurse mitigating the loss of Patrick McCaw?
Well, as we know, you know, Patrick hasn't really been available early through the first six games. So I think you'll see more of Terrence. I think, as we've already seen and we've all discussed, more of Pascal Siakam handling the basketball. And I think that you'll have Kyle and Fred there as well. And so essentially you'll have four ball handlers, with Terrence obviously coming on, in off of the bench, with a mix, obviously, of Fred on the floor, Kyle on the floor, and or Pascal on the floor at that time.
Matt, let's turn on the mic, Rich. Matt, one of the things that I think has been a really good sign in the last 48 hours or so, 72 hours, is Pascal's acceptance of what Nick was talking about in terms of not taking silly fouls and the importance of staying on the court. And I feel like, Matt, that's now compounded, given that his ability to bring the ball up becomes that much more important now that you've dropped a little bit of depth in McCaw being out.
Well, I think that any great player, as we know from following sports, they accept criticism. They want to get better. They want to get coached. And Pascal Siakam, you know, is heading toward that status. He wants to be better. And Nick Nurse, you know, clearly the things that he said the other day, he had conversations with Pascal leading up to that, right? So it wasn't probably the first time that Pascal had heard that. And so for Pascal, it is important for him to move his feet, not use his hands, to stay off of, stay out of early foul trouble. He's already been disqualified twice, fouled out two times. Milwaukee, you know, two fouls within the first 6 minutes. It is compounded by what you just talked about. However, knowing Pascal, knowing what he's been able to do through his development, I think he's going to be able to make that leap.
Matt, I know we're only six or seven games into the season, but can you give listeners a sense of how different the quote-unquote the room is without Kawhi Leonard and Danny Green there? Whatever the culture is now, how is it different without those two guys?
I don't think that there's much difference. You know, I think this is a group that believes in itself. They go about their daily routine, their daily work. They take it as it comes, right? They don't get too up. They don't get too down. I think it's essentially a continuation of what we saw last season. So I don't think that, even with Danny or with Kawhi not being present, I still think that it's there. Part of the reason why is you have certainly the experience of Kyle, but you have Marc Gasol. And then a player that a lot of people don't realize that does have a voice in the room is Fred VanVleet. He's a true leader, an extension of the coach on the court, and is somebody that has that ability to stand in front of the room and carry a lot of respect. And that's something that he did in years past. It's something that will continue now.
Hey, Matt, with Terrence Davis getting an expanded role here, those of us, you know, who sort of watch the Raptors a little bit, I mean, I'm fully expecting him to be the next Fred VanVleet. I mean, I'm overstating things, but this is an organization that has had a lot of success with lower first-round picks, guys that other teams maybe passed on or didn't value as much. What is it about Masai Ujiri and the way this team, and I'm talking about his front office in general, analyzes players that allows them to do this? Because this is a trend. And I think it's safe to say that this is part of this organization's DNA.
Well, I think a lot of people through the years always looked at San Antonio as that team. And I think that the Toronto Raptors, as we now know, are one of those teams as well that people look at. It's their scouting staff, certainly, that is out there on a daily basis, that finds the players, then obviously alerts, you know, Masai, Bobby, Dan Tolsman, hey, here are the players that we want to go out and see. And when you also have the development model that the Raptors have and have had success with that, you know, then players as well as agents want to put their players in those positions because they have a track record of a Pascal Siakam, of a DeLon Wright. They have a track record of Fred VanVleet. And, you know, the list obviously goes on and on. Mm-hmm. And so for the Raptors, when, you know, you have to have, you know, the feet on the ground, the scouts that are out there, and they have, albeit, you know, they have a smaller group, but yet they traverse the, you know, the continent, the world, to find players, and they do an amazing job at that. And then you combine that with the development program that the Raptors have, and you'll have success. That doesn't mean that there's not going to be growing pains, right? We saw, you know, there was even growth with Fred VanVleet during the postseason. If you want to be a really good player, there's always going to be growth, and it's not always in a straight trajectory. That sometimes there's ebbs and flows to it and ups and downs, and I would imagine we'll see some of that with Terrence. But he has a great build, he can defend, and he's got great vision, and I look forward to seeing his development.
Matt, how far away is Marc Gasol from finding his offensive game again?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. Is it just one night where he goes out and scores 20 and it's, you know, there it is? Is it just being more assertive early on? Because as we know, last season, you know, he realized quickly that, yes, he was a great facilitator. The usage rate for him was down, but others was up. The offense flowed through him. So, and with him on the court, it's a good question. I think that's something that we're going to see here. You know, it's interesting because you have six games within the first 17 days, and now all of a sudden we have a situation where the Raptors are going to play four games in 6 days, right? And so, you know, things are going to start to come at the Raptors a little bit faster. And I think that there might be some good to that, too. I don't know if I can ever remember a week where they played three games. Mm-hmm. It is a lot of time. And everybody's been talking about minutes and stuff. Minutes. I mean, like, you played last Saturday. Right. And before that, you played Wednesday. You know, minutes are going to start coming here, you know, come Friday, Sunday, Monday, Wednesday, right?
One of the things that Nick Nurse said regarding Pascal Siakam, and I'm paraphrasing here, Matt, so if I'm wrong, please correct me, but... But one of the things I was left with the impression yesterday was that as he was talking about the fouls and the turnovers, the idea that he didn't want Pascal to expend a great deal of energy arguing with officials or talking to officials. It's one thing this organization, and I know, Matt, you've talked about this, it's changed a little bit in the past year or so, I would say, in terms of the relations with officials. How much of this is just simply, you know, the rest of NBA officials need to realize that Pascal is as good as he is. You know what I mean? I'm not saying he's going to get,
I mean, look,
I'm not saying he should get some favoritism, but
yeah, but there's some of that. If you look at some of the, if you look at some of those fouls, you're almost like, really? Like, really? Like a touch foul? Like, really? But as we all know, I, and you, Jeff, I know, I think you don't agree with me on this, but I think it's the hardest officiating job that's out there. The speed, how the size difference between the players, the proximity of the fans to the playing surface. I just think that it is a really difficult job in that every time down you can blow a whistle, and it's varying degrees of what is happening out there on the floor, and they have a difficult task in front of them. But I do think that there is some of, okay, Pascal, we need you offensively. We want you to play great defense. Let's just stay away from some of those, you know, what you would call ticky-tack fouls early, and then, you know, let's kind of get established here.
Right.
Matt, you know, you don't want to overemphasize, first, a singular game, and even, secondly, a road trip. That said, tell me if you agree with me or disagree with me, but I feel like we're going to find out a lot about, maybe a lot's too strong, we're going to find out something about this group when they play the Lakers, the Clippers, the Mavericks, and the Blazers, because that is going to be a very tough environment against some of the best, potentially, teams that could be in the finals. Like, that's really going to be high-level basketball early in the year, and I feel like we're going to learn something. You agree?
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree that I think that we'll find out here over the course. You know, you look at tonight's game against Sacramento, then New Orleans on Friday. After that, it's Lakers-Clippers. Then it's Portland, a team that's struggling a little bit right now. And then on to Dallas, a team that's Luka Doncic. I think that we'll find out about this team for early on in the season, right? I mean, let's remember, this is, you know, something that is always, inclusive of last year, always a work in progress, right?
Right.
Matt, thank you so much for joining us today. Look forward to your call tonight.
All right, we appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Enjoy Take the care. Kinks.
All right, all the best.
All righty. Matt Devlin, our Raptors play-by-play voice on Sportsnet. Again, we'll have the game Bucks and Clippers 10 o'clock tonight on Sportsnet. When Richard, it was interesting, Matt talking about Pascal. And I know we talked about this a bit yesterday with Hubie Brown. But it's the idea that the NBA is a reputation league when it comes to officiating. And Hubie mentioned there are a lot of new officials in the league. And I'm wondering if the fact that Pascal is now, by and large, the offensive focal point for this team. I mean, as much as anybody who isn't Kyle Lowry is. You know, we talked about the pressure that comes with that and the expectations. I wonder if maybe Pascal doesn't, it's also incumbent on him to change his demeanor a little bit on the court and realize, and I'm not criticizing because I haven't seen every trip down the floor with Pascal, but I think he's also got to realize he is, the focus is on him now. And if he gets to be one of the game's truly elite players, when the focus is on him, the call's going to go his way. But right now, I think he's at that stage where he's kind of something new, something surprising. And the focus being on him doesn't necessarily mean he is going to get the call in his favor all the time. You know, that's the way the game is officiated.
Yeah, listen.
It just is. And that should be, because it's a star-driven sport.
Two things there, which you hit on, that are always very interesting to me. One, a reputation league. That is beyond a shadow of a doubt true. Whether it's LeBron or KD or Steph Curry, and certainly James Harden, Jeff. These guys consistently, I think, get the benefit of the call when they are on offense and sort of being proactive in the play. You know, them making whatever move it is, they generally speaking, more than not, get that call, especially if they drive in the lane. So that's part one. Part two, This is something that I think Kyle Lowry is kind of a genius on. Kyle Lowry essentially complains almost every time he's touched. You agree?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, I know at a certain point it probably like drives refs insane, but the psychology of that is pretty brilliant because I think at a certain point, if you say enough times, this guy's tagging me, this guy's tagging me, you are going to get a call, maybe even a call you don't deserve. And and I think Siakam has to, at a certain point, Jeff, realize that he is the focal point in the offense. And I think he's going to have to, even if he's investing in a call in the fourth quarter, I think he's going to have to let the refs know this guy's on me.
Well, there's a couple of things. You know, Kyle's been in the league for a long time now.
Right.
Pascal is still, he's not a newcomer, but he's a relative. Yeah. He's a new star.
Yeah.
But I also like what Matt said. And I think this is really kind of the key. And it's probably what Nick was getting at yesterday. What Nick Nurse was getting at is try to maybe eliminate that early foul.
Agreed.
Like, you know, you shouldn't be fatigued 6, 7, 8 minutes into the game. You know, fatigued to the point where you're going to take. I mean, there are times you're going to be wrong place, wrong time. Something's going to happen. You're going to get a foul called on you. That's the way it is. That's the way it is. But if you can kind of eliminate that lazy sort of lame foul in the first quarter and basically save that foul.
Yes.
Save that foul for farther down the road. And I think that's really what Nick is getting at is while we are letting this stuff percolate and while we are letting, you know, whatever, letting our team's identity develop, let's try to stay in the game as long as we can.
Right.
And when I say stay in the game, I mean, let's try to avoid getting in foul trouble. Because the one thing about Pascal, it's one of his strengths is also one of his weaknesses. There's a lot of arms and a lot of legs moving around when he's there.
Yeah, and a lot of motor.
So he's going to be in a lot of, I'm going to bore a hockey phrase, he's going to be in a lot of greasy areas.
Yeah. The thing that Pascal has to learn, and I think you will, Jeff, is first quarter, you're, let's say, up 14-10, and a guy beats you basically to the spot. The best players understand that there are times to let that go and give up the layup. Why?
Absolutely.
Because in the fourth quarter, you playing with 4 fouls as opposed to 5
Absolutely.
Is a game changer.
Absolutely.
It's just that gives you far more freedom offensively to sort of create and do what you want. And then secondly, I'd rather you make that foul, 92-91, guy goes to the hoop, and you drill him, and he doesn't get the shot off.
Yeah.
That's a far more effective foul than 14-10, 8-6 in the first. I think he will learn that. And then secondly, I think as his numbers continue to grow, I do think it's a star-driven league, and I do think the refs will give him probably some more benefit of the doubt as the season goes on and even next year goes on. Because I do think Lowry and, you know, the Kawhis of the world, the Hardens of the world, if you watch enough basketball, I know you do, those guys get 80%. When it's a 50-50 call, they get 80% of that.
And the other thing, too, that Kawhi or Kyle has, a big advantage Kyle has is his size difference.
Yeah.
Kyle gets knocked to the floor subconsciously. You're thinking small guy knocked down by
big guy.
And
Kyle plays it up.
Kyle plays it up perfectly.
He slides after he gets hit.
He might be the best.
He gesticulates.
I watch basketball differently now than I did back when I was watching the Bird Celtics and Magic and that. But I don't know if there's anybody as effective at getting charges called than Kyle. Kyle has a knack for it.
Yeah.
Kyle has an absolute knack for it.
He's a great defender against guys bigger than him, which is a real, which is not an easy
thing. Hard to do.
Easy thing to do. But, you know, like the reality is, like, you know, we have seen the league forever. And, like, the best players do get, certainly on offense, get the benefit of the doubt. And I'm sure the coaching staff is doing this, but, like, I think sometimes Pascal's just going to have to, like, not necessarily yell at a ref, but like get in the ref's ear and say, this guy's doing this. You just want to make it's gamesmanship, but you want to make the ref think about it.
Yeah, I don't know how I feel about that. I don't know how I feel
I think it's
about
just part of the NBA. I think they all do it. The best players are always, if you notice when you're watching a game, there's always sort of a corner shot of the best players in the league talking to the
refs.
But
I think you need to have a certain level of experience in order for the referees to listen to you.
I agree with that.
Up to a certain point, in your career, you're just noise. You're a nuisance.
Yes.
If you're talking to the officials, you're almost background noise. You get to a point where you establish a reputation. And look, and Pascal's doing that. And this, I think this is the year he takes that final step forward and his reputation is
you see him
solidified.
At the All-Star game, the refs know. I mean, the refs
exactly.
watch TV too.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. He was one of the heroes of Toronto FC's win over Atlanta in the Eastern Conference final. He will likely have to be one of the heroes as well next week if Toronto FC is to win the MLS Cup. He's Quentin Westberg. He's Toronto FC's keeper. Quentin Westberg joins Richard Deitch and myself. This is Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 360.
Oddshark.net is your source for the latest odds from leading authorities, expert editorial content, and detailed matchup picks. Looking for statistics and trends from an upcoming game? Oddshark.net has that too, and it's free.
It's free.
Expert in-depth analysis, stats, numbers, and trends to help you make the sharp game day picks.
Whether you want to get in on the football action,
tonight's baseball game, or anything in between, head over to Oddshark.net and start playing like a shark today. This is not a gambling site.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
See, this is what I'm talking about. Jen Rolnick, strong choice. Waterloo by ABBA. I used to get in a debate with some of my more musically inclined brethren, writers like Shinen.
About ABBA?
Yeah, I'd said that I think ABBA is least as significant as the Beatles when it comes to the history of world music.
They're significant, but that's... I mean, you just gave them to the Jordan level. But ABBA, I think ABBA is actually underrated in terms of influence.
Catchiest pop songs around. Like, the amount of catchy pop music that they churned out...
That's a lot.
Tremendous.
Also helped by the fact that haven't they had a long-running Broadway show forever that...
I went to it. I don't know if it's still going on.
Younger generations.
Mamma Mia. Yeah,
it's still going on. Thank you, Derek. That people have become familiar with their work.
So Jen Rolnick is, again, it's Wednesday, so there's 2 days to go. But Derek, I'm going to have to nuke my list because I'm being, this Jen's list is just shredding. Shredding. This is our guilty pleasure week, by the way.
Jen Rolnick's
list is just shredding us.
I'm actually curious for your list.
No, it's not. It's lame now. I feel almost as if it's been emasculated by this.
By this one?
I might have to change. I might have to come up with some.
You got Metallica on there?
Metallica is not a guilty pleasure. Metallica is one of the greatest metal bands of all time.
Well, you just mentioned metal, so I'm curious.
That's not a guilty pleasure.
Well, a Metallica song can be a guilty pleasure. The band itself,
You misunderstand guilty pleasure.
Well, you saw
guilty
my list. Clearly, I did. I got yelled at.
You would be so embarrassed.
I got yelled at for putting Missy Elliott on my...
Because that's some people consider that a classic.
I know. I think I might have misinterpreted.
We mentioned the Toronto FC. How can you misinterpret guilty pleasures? Anyhow, Toronto FC will take on Seattle in the MLS Cup. On Sunday. I think I said Wednesday. I don't know what I was thinking of. It's... amongst the storylines for the MLS Cup, I'm thinking Wednesday. Amongst the storylines for the MLS Cup is the fact that it will pit Stefan Fry, who was the Sounders keeper, Toronto FC's keepers in years gone by, and of course Quentin Westberg, who is Toronto FC's current keeper. And who had a hell of a game against Atlanta, and quite frankly, is one of the major reasons that Toronto FC is playing in this thing. I'm always intrigued to talk to keepers because they get a view of their teammates that the rest of us don't get. Field level, they get to see stuff develop. They get to see trends. They get to see habits develop. Quentin Westberg of Toronto FC joins Richard Deitch and myself on Writer's Block. Quentin, thanks so much for joining us today. Greatly appreciate it. Congratulations on getting to the finals. I said hell of a game against Atlanta, but I wanted to ask you, when did you get the sense that this team was good enough to get to the MLS Cup?
Well, hi guys. Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure. It's a good question. I think the fun part in all of that is that we didn't really know. It's just this winning culture that there is at the club, this recent past that has been so successful for the club. And it's just in there. You know, at some point when times were a little harder, guys were just talking about, let's make it to the playoffs. And we've got the experience for these games. And then who knows what happens. And then we started, you know, getting unbeaten for 2 games, 4 games, 6 games, and then 8 games. And then through the season, it was 10. And then, you know, we were fortunate enough to stage a home game in the first game of the playoffs. And this one was pretty epic, but it went our way. And then we just, you know, this momentum that we've been having is, it's just there. And we don't really ask ourselves any questions. We just show up and give everything we got and just, you know, keep going what we've been doing lately and you know, representing the city.
Quentin, how has this week, if it has indeed been different, how has this week been different in terms of preparing for the MLS Cup versus any other postseason game or any other regular season game?
To be honest, it hasn't changed that much in a way that, okay, there's more attention and everything, but in the same way that, you know, in June, you know, end of May, June, when the results weren't as good as we all expected, it wasn't like a crisis mode. Now it's just, you know, okay, it's very positive. There's great energy, but it's still very humble and still very down to earth, you know, because we still have a great game to play. It's great to be one of the only 2 teams getting ready for the final, knowing that all 22 others are still, you know, will be watching on TV and are basically on vacation or postseason. Well, everybody's enthusiastic, but still very down to earth in a way that we know we still have a great game to play and we absolutely need to get ready.
Quentin, one of your real strengths, in addition, obviously, to shot stopping and leadership, which your teammates have talked about, is your ability to distribute the ball. I don't know if it was Josie Alter or one of your players said it's basically like having an outfield player back there. We've seen this become more and more of a trend, I think, in recent years in football where keepers, you know, a lot of us will think of somebody like Manuel Neuer, for example. Keepers are being asked to assume more of an outfield role. How do you find the balance, you know, to ensure that you're doing that while also adhering to your defensive responsibilities?
Well, don't get me wrong. My first and foremost responsibility is the shot stop. But I was raised, you know, I've always been passionate about soccer and I've always played soccer throughout my life. And the only moment I would go in goal is when there were like actual responsibilities and in an actual club with actual coaches and everything. But the rest of the time, and that means a lot of hours, you know, I was always on the field. I was always, you know, out there playing. And whether it was alone working on just my skills, juggling, I always had a ball to my feet. And I always felt and played and developed, you know, as a soccer player. So I think it helped me a lot in the understanding of what it is to be on the field. And then, and to be able to use it as a keeper to understand, you know, that they run way more than we do and that they have a lot of efforts to make and all these things. It helps me to understand more about being on the field and also understanding the game more.
Quentin,
this to my mind has helped.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry about that. Jumping on you there. I'm someone who's always been sort of obsessed with PKs. I think they're just fascinating to me to try to get in the mind of a goalie. I don't know if it's because I saw Sylvester Stallone, you know, make that save in Victory when I was a little kid, but whatever. I'm fascinated by that. And so you are really good when it comes to PKs. And I wonder if you could take our audience just sort of inside as the guy is about to approach the ball and shoot. Like, what are you thinking? Do you try to guess one side? Is part of that scouting? Like, how do you approach PKs? Because you've been really, really good at it, and particularly lately.
No, well, there are different patterns. You know, some players have habits. Some others don't. Then I like to be very, very honest. I like to keep an instinct. And, you know, you said it all when you said it's a mind game. You need to embrace it and kind of isolate yourself into this mind game with the with the forward that's about to take the PK. It's only you and him, and you know, just forget about everything around it. The minute in the game, the context, everything is just you and him basically. And to be honest, I like the thrill about it, you know. And most of the time, of course, the guy on the ball has the edge, but it's fighting these odds that's fun, and that, you know, you get the thrill, and being able to be also there for your team is a great feeling, and to try and go get that feeling is really exciting. And this is maybe what brings the strength into you and makes you guess or feel, or I follow my gut. You know, I study a little bit. I see if the player has habits and has a side that he prefers. But in the end, I never know where I'm gonna dive before a PK. I like to think I have an idea, but it can change at the last second. And for example, in Atlanta, I decided right as he was shooting. No, I didn't walk into the game thinking, okay, I'm going to dive to my right.
Hmm. Quentin, you have both French and American parents. You also were at Clairefontaine, which is the French football academy, which is famous. I mean, it's the model throughout Europe for academies for developing national team caliber players. You have to take an entrance exam, I believe, to get into it. I wanted to ask you, you're kind of part of that generation of French players that has come up, you know, on the backs of those World Cup teams and those European champions. Just tell us a little bit about how you've seen the sport change in France and what it was like to going through that process of getting into Clairefontaine.
Well, getting into Clairefontaine is quite a challenge. I mean, I think at the time there were like four stages, and I didn't even apply. Like my club team coach, I was drawing interest from different professional clubs as I was 13 years old, and I was playing in this tiny club. And my coach at the time said, "Okay, well, if you're that good, obviously Paris PSG want to try Clairefontaine. Clairefontaine is the best academy they can be. Try out. I will make sure I will apply for you, and I will take you." And I went through one stage, a second stage, a third stage, and then to like a 3-day kind of trial with everybody that remained there. There were like 40 kids, I think, and only 20 were going to be offered a spot. And it happened. You know, I just basically showed up every time, you know, because I kept getting, you know, these invites. And in general, Clairefontaine is an unbelievable place. It doesn't guarantee a professional career, you know, but it sets the way. And I mean, from a very, very early age, you learn and you realize how competitive this sport is and how many people and how many kids dream of being professionals, you know. And this is what it taught me the most, you know, aside from all the technical and the, you know, learning how to be a professional, and also growing up as a man in this environment, it taught me a lot of values, you know, and respect and humility and everything. But most of all, it's about, you know, if you don't do the job even for a month or a week or a day, someone will try and take your spot and profit that opening that you're leaving him. And this highly, highly competitive environment has taught me a lot, because in France, I mean, everyone plays soccer and everyone dreams of being a professional soccer player. And there are just not many spots open. And it's just, you know, giving everything and never giving up.
Quentin, what's the mood of the team like right now?
Focused. That's for sure. I'm really liking what I see, in a way that I don't feel guys, they're not okay with just showing up, you know? So the team is the exact same that it has been this past month, you know, and we're not wondering, we're not dreaming, we're not, you know, we're just getting focused and on a mission, and that's an actual very good feeling.
Quentin, we appreciate you joining us. Best of luck in the MLS Cup. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Quentin.
Take care. Quentin Westberg of Toronto FC. They will play the Seattle Sounders. And Richard, was a great question. He is
good.
He is,
interview.
He
that
has
guy's.
Made his. He's made his mark as a a shot stopper. But, you know, if you talk to the Toronto FC people, and they'll tell you, too, there's an element of leadership you need out of your keeper. Basically, you need a guy who's going to communicate with people, tell them where to go a lot of the times when stuff is happening. But the whole, if people are interested in it, do further reading on Claire Fontaine, because it is you know, I mean, the German program, a lot of the things that the German program utilized to turn its national team around were principles that were established to Claire Fontaine. Belgium has done the same thing. St. George's Park in England, they've always had kind of an academy, but Claire Fontaine was the, you know, that's an academy. Like, you got to pass a written test. You got to be a great player, but basically you have to have somebody almost assume responsibility for you, as his coach did, because he came from a very small team. You almost have to have somebody champion your cause, and there's a political element to it, but there's also, which I find really fascinating, the written exam part. You come out of that, you're a soccer student, and chances are you're going to go on and coach. And I think, as Quentin said, you're not guaranteed a job in professional, you're not guaranteed to be a professional soccer player, but you have enough of a background that you can go on from there to coach, for example, or to be an executive. So, I mean, if people are interested any further, just do some reading on Claire Fontaine, because it's a lot of what you see with Hockey Canada, like all this whole notion of trying to create a system that teaches things in addition to just bringing people together to compete for a national team. A lot of it's based on Claire Fontaine. And Quentin's an interesting story. American and French parents. He played for the U.S. under, I believe, under 17. He was named to the team. And he's been a godsend for this team. Alex Bono was great when Toronto FC won the MLS Cup. He had a bit of a wobble last year. He's still young. But Quentin Westberg has really been a guy that has just settled stuff down there. And you were right, Richard. He is... And it was interesting hearing him say that a lot of what he does is instinctual. It's not necessarily looking at, you know, cheat sheets or scouting.
Yeah, really, really interesting guy. And, Jeff, talking about sort of the French development, you know, you see the quality of this goalie, and you just realize how many great players they produce. I mean, if he's... And he's good, but he's in the MLS. You know, he's not in the Premier League. He's not in the French League. So, interesting story just for him to obviously get to where he is now. But I really liked his sort of taking us a little bit inside into how he thinks. And just the fact that, like, he made a last-second decision on the save against Martinez, that mm-hmm. turned the game around.
That was the game,
yeah,
I would argue.
I agree with you. So, that literally, that's the difference between that split-second decision is the difference between them being in the MLS Cup or not.
Yeah, and again, we wish Toronto FC well. Sunday, the MLS Cup against the Seattle Sounders. Stephen Fry, 81 regular season games for the Reds before moving on. It's funny, in a lot of ways, you can kind of trace the history of the Reds through their keepers. So Stephen Fry, certainly no stranger to Toronto FC. He was the keeper when the Sounders lost to Toronto FC. Here is also the keeper, I believe he was the keeper when the Sounders won the MLS Cup as well. I could be wrong about that. But anyhow, we appreciate Quentin Westberg joining us, and thanks so much to Toronto FC for making their keeper available, 3 days ahead of the championship game. It's greatly appreciated, and they have our thanks. We'll take a break. Richard Deitch and myself will be back with more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
How can I just let you walk away? Just let you leave without a trace? When I stand in...
Oh my God, this makes me want to get one of those apps on the phone with the lighter, you know, and hold it up.
This is against all odds or no?
Jen, like I said, Jen is really...
Against All Odds by Phil Collins.
She set the bar impossibly high for our Guilty Pleasure.
There's a movie where this is like the... It's a sports film where this is like the lead song. It's Rachel Ward and Jeff Bridges, I think. But for the life of me, I can't think of the film.
Okay.
I'll be one of the guys.
Does that count if I hold the lighter up like I'm doing on TV, the app that has the lighter?
Nice.
Huh?
Yeah, right now Jen is in the lead in terms of she's sort of 4 for 4 or 3 for 3.
When did the lighter in the concert become a thing?
Feels like a late 80s, 90s
thing. Yeah, it was like, you know, for the slow song, everybody would.
Yeah, it feels like you too, like, always sort of saw everybody holding lighters for their concerts.
Yeah. I always had a better use for my lighter, to be quite honest, at a rock concert.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Enjoying a bit of the...
There's always something. You can always find something at a concert if you're bored.
Le Chronique.
So... French newspaper. So Jen's apparently going to send something out where we're going to be spiced up, so to speak.
Really?
Yeah.
Using the
she wants
television to, graphics.
Well, I kind of wanted to be sporty spice.
You can be whatever you want, man. I'm team player.
Yeah, sporty spice would probably be my choice if I could be in.
What was Victoria Beckham? Though. I really don't remember. What was her spice? What was she was posh?
Posh. Yeah.
She was posh. Okay. Yeah. And then.
Scary, ginger, sporty.
One other woman went on.
Baby Spice was the other
Baby
one.
Baby Spice, yeah. There was, I feel like one other woman went on to pretty big fame. Did a lot of like.
Jerry Halliwell's done a ton of stuff.
Yeah, but isn't there a woman who's sort of still on the air and doing like reality show or competition show stuff in England? I don't know who I'm thinking of. Anyway.
Yeah.
Jen, ring a bell. They made a ton of cash. For their time in in the spotlight.
There you go. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, we should ask people who would be which Spice Girl, who would be which Backstreet Boy.
Talk about a horrible band.
No, they're great.
Don't put them on.
Don't.
No, that's terrible, Jeff. Listen.
I went into Wahlburgers, Toronto, when they were in concert. They were here. They had a whole area up top reserved.
Come on. You like Hanson? Enjoyed those?
I have no problem with any of those bands. I really don't. Pop music's great. See, I separate my musical. Pop music's fine. There are no rules for pop music.
Well, there's a lot of terrible pop music, though.
That's fine. It's pop music. It's not meant to be deep or meaningful or... It's just supposed to be fun. I've got my music when I'm serious about stuff.
Right.
You know, or when I need... You know, I've got different sets of music, stuff to relax, stuff to medicate, things of that nature, right? You got to have it spread out. But pop music's fine.
I've never heard you on this show mention jazz. Do you like jazz at all?
I do not like jazz. I do not have let me rephrase it. I do not have an ear for jazz. It's not that I don't like it.
Not even like something like Miles Davis, like classic.
Don't have an ear for it. I understand completely why people like jazz. Will I listen to it? I'll listen to any jazz. I'll listen to any
kind
jazz.
Of blue. I think is
so. I don't dislike it. I just don't have the ear for it.
No, I respect that. Kind of blue. I think is one of the five best albums of all time.
To me, I'm not smart enough to understand jazz. I'm just not. I'm not smart enough to understand jazz. I'm not wired that way. But I completely get it. And you know, if it's on, if we're at a dinner party and somebody's got jazz on, I love it. I have no problem with it. I just couldn't name.
What about are you listening to classical at all? Trying to think of different genres.
Christmas, I listen to classical.
I love Christmas music.
Not Christmas music. Well, that's a difference.
I know, I get it.
But I like. I will listen to I like the Berlin Philharmonic and stuff like that.
Oh yeah,
One day a year.
Okay.
One day a year. But now jazz, I always feel guilty because everybody I know likes jazz, and people I really admire like jazz. Brunt's father was a jazz musician, so the history of it and everything. I get it completely. So if you're a jazz fan, don't call up or send us emails or whatever saying I'm a Philistine.
What instrument did Brunt's father play?
I don't know.
You don't know.
But I get it. I get why you like jazz. I just don't have the ear for it.
Okay.
I'm more a reggae guy.
Well, reggae is great too. I'm surprised though, because if you like reggae, which sort of is impulsive and creative, I would think you would jump on jazz too.
Yeah, never.
All right.
Never had the ear for
it. Learn something new.
Completely get it, though. Completely get it. Tim Turk is an NHL shooting and scoring coach. I've got a couple of hockey teams he could work for. Tim Turk Hockey. He is going to join us to talk about the disappearance, amongst other things, the disappearance of the slap shot, which is a topic near and dear to my heart. Tim Turk's next. And then Pete Caldera is going to come on and sing for us. Very musical show. We're musically inclined. It's Writer's Block on 590 and 360.
You're experiencing Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
So I remember Bobby Hull blazing down the side, winding up for slap shot. A little bit of Bernie Jeffrey on. I'm a big fan of the slap shot. It's kind of disappeared from the NHL. It's disappeared from the NHL for a variety of reasons, the speed of the game. But it just doesn't seem, you know, it's to the point now, Richard, and I talked about this in the first hour of the show. The Washington Capitals are in town. John Carlson winds up for a slap shot, holds it, and then just blisters the puck. And I remember thinking, sitting in the press box watching that, thinking, I can't remember the last time I've seen anybody let a bona fide slap shot. He scored on it, too. Can't remember the last time I'd seen a bona fide slap shot going. It used to be such a part of the game. It used to be, you know, the two things that were the expression of masculinity in the NHL were, one, the ability to beat the hell out of everybody, and two, the big booming slap shot. So I found myself wondering about this. Sonny Sachdeva is a sports writer with sportsnet.ca, and I don't know if he was channeling. I have no idea why, but he wrote a story up on the website, the Sportsnet website, talking to NHL shooting and scoring coach, skills coach, Tim Turk of Tim Turk Hockey. It was exactly what I was thinking about as I was watching that game. We're very pleased to be joined by Tim Turk. Tim, thanks so much for joining Richard Deitch and myself today. Swear to God, it was the funniest thing because I remember everybody in the press box is looking at each other and saying, when's the last time you've seen somebody just crank one like that? You just don't see it anymore. And lo and behold, here is this story. Tell us who stole the slap shot, and is there something I can do to help you bring it back, Tim? Should we want to bring it back?
You know, in my opinion, I think it got stolen by all the rule changes a bunch of years ago. And, yeah, we can bring that thing back just to make sure that we create a six-hole on the goalie instead of just the five holes that they have.
Right.
Just for the power purposes. But, you know, like as I said to Sonny, I'm like, you got to have really good preparation skills. You got a great technique, and you got to have some vision to be able to prepare and pick that shot and when you need to take it and from where on the ice. So I would try and bring it back, but you know, it'd be so challenging to do so with the speed of the game. Now, you know, you might have that opportunity during a 5-on-4, more so with a 5-on-3, like we kind of witnessed there the other night. That one shot that Carlson took was unbelievable. There's some excellent criteria that he did just to get that shot off and pick a right spot while he did it.
Tell me what some of the rules changes that had an impact on this. Explain that to us a bit.
So back in the day, you'd be able to kind of stand in somebody's way and slow them up a little bit. You might even be able to take a hand off your stick and clutch or grab onto someone. You know, you don't want to call it a holding penalty, but it's like a quick little tug, and that changes someone's speed kind of thing, and that would create a little bit more time back then. And then there's the hook. You know, like if you remember in the old days, even when Rick Five had the opportunity to fly down the wing and receive a pass and then wind up, like in his load up was like he was picking apples, you know, when he was taking that shot, but he was creating so much power because he had so much time. So that hooking, that clutching, that grabbing, that obstruction, those kinds of little things where they're clamping down on that to, you know, just to ensure that the game is played with speed and there's just, you know, no enforcement of any of that stuff anymore. They don't need to because it's just out of the game, well, almost out of the game anyways.
Tim, how would you go about teaching someone a slap shot?
Well, it goes in stages. You know, like what I do with the players, whether they're a minor hockey player that I need to help with their body position, or a 5 to 7 tenure NHL pro. You need to, number one, you need to get them to understand what they're doing with the motion pattern so that they can connect their mind to the action of a style of shot they're taking. So I always start with a stationary puck, and I'll have the player, you know, with motion skate into it so I can measure where their stick's hitting the ice, where the puck's positioned in their feet when they get to it, what their body does before, during, and after the shot. It's very critical nowadays. And, you know, if the common thing for right-handed shots after they take any kind of shot, more specifically a slap shot, is they'll kind of turn right because they're generating so much torque through their lower body. The lefties will turn left, and the big thing we want to do is ensure that technically after they're taking a shot, they're heading towards the target, or they're heading towards the direction of the puck to help them to possibly react on anything that could come next if the biscuit doesn't go in the net.
Tim, how much of your teaching involves what is in front of the player when they are shooting, either a defenseman tipping the puck, traffic in front of the net, or a goaltender who happens to be of a certain size or a certain style?
It's a great question. When you're a shooter, and, you know, like, depending on the level you're playing, and obviously the higher the level, the harder it is to get closer to the target, or it's just a lot more difficult. So those players have to kind of identify and recognize targets before the target. So when you're talking about shooting lanes or sticking lanes and stuff like that, if that player has the ability and the confidence to kind of like locate or have their head up prior to releasing to see where that initial target is to get it through to the end target or to create some sort of action on the puck, that's a big, big thing for them to be able to identify. So we teach that as much as possible. Recognize where you need to shoot the puck. And then in a defensive position, you know, if you can picture a relief pass from the half wall or the hash mark on the boards back to the D, and the D's got to kind of feel like he needs to create an angle. A lot of the defensive coaches in minor hockey, they're getting them to drag or slide across the blue into the dot line or the dot lane or pass there to get to the front of the net where an easier angle is possible, where I'm trying to get it there as quick as possible. As soon as you prepare it off the pass, locate where that, you know, where that zone coverage is or where that obstruction is and get it through right away.
How many current NHLers do you think, let me rephrase this question, players who have established themselves in the NHL, are we at the stage yet where they are sort of looking to add a slap shot to their arsenal? In other words, perhaps their main strength is, you know, snapshot or wrist shot or whatever. Can you do that as an NHLer? Decide, let's say I'm 27 years old and go, you know, I want to add this to my arsenal. Do you see guys doing that?
Absolutely. And it's just to me, the introduction of a slap shot can happen in many different loading ranges. You know, as soon as you load your stick back or your power side of your body, if you're righty, it's your right side, so your right arm starts loading away from the puck, you know, you have like a low range, a mid range, a full range kind of ability to take that shot. And then if you've recognized that you have the time to do so, that's going to dictate how much you load up. So in the case of Carlson the other night there, and he said the one thing I wanted to point out was, you know, he received a pass, a cross-ice pass, and as soon as the puck touched his blade, he was aware it was there, and his head kind of went up, and he honed in on a target right away without even looking at while he was moving. He was moving, the puck was moving. He, you know, he let some cross crease action go on, you know, where there's impaired vision there. He delayed and then took a shot. So he knew he had the time, so that was a full-range load. He loaded it right up and had the opportunity to get full power on that. So in the other case, maybe if there's pressure, then, you know, if he had to release that quick, but he's made the choice to take a slap shot, then that load range might be a little shorter. So anytime you take your stick off the ice away from the puck, to me, it's going to result in some sort of a slap shot.
Tim, how much does skating speed of the player impact the slap shot?
The build up of momentum can create more power on your shot. So if you build up a high rate of speed and you have that ability to find the target within the target to get it to the net, the more speed you have, the more power you can induce in the puck if your body's aligned properly and you're doing the correct things when you're loading up and impacting. You know, the stick has to hit the ice. There's this big, huge misconception. And I'll ask players all the time, even at the NHL level and NHL coaches, when I get the opportunity to get on the ice with them, I'm like, how far behind the puck do you think the stick blade hits it when the player's taking a loaded or a full-range slap shot? Well, the answer is commonly like, you know, 2 inches to 6 inches behind the puck, and that's kind of far from the truth. You know, the naked eye shows that that's what it looks like, but that stick's actually hitting between 18 and 24 inches behind the puck prior to hitting or making impact with the puck and a slap shot. Mm-hmm. So it is so critical on, you know, the stick that you're using, the height of the stick, the flex of the stick, you know, your technique and all that stuff needs to be practiced in the off season so that you can transition it to these games. And then, you know, a lot of times we want to make sure we're teaching these guys that under pressure they can do stuff. And then if we can accelerate their speed when they're doing it, then it's an easier transition to take it to games, depending on their reversion rates.
In conversation with NHL shooting and scoring coach Tim Turk. Tim, one of the things that I find interesting, you know, looking at some of the players you've worked with, among them, Mitch Marner, a guy who's shifty, a guy who is capable of, you know, passing the puck. He's got great vision and all that. Is maybe part of the reason players don't take a slap shot anymore is it's viewed to be kind of greedy, you know? It's almost, hey, this is me. I'm taking the shot. Get the hell out of the way. Is there that sort of that sense that maybe it's a little too selfish to take a slap shot now?
Yeah, I would agree with that somewhat. But, you know, ultimately when the player at that level is playing at the most elite level possible, they want that puck to go in the net. And to me, like, it's hard to make that choice where if I have the opportunity to take the slap shot, I'm gonna rip it, because if it doesn't go in, I need to produce a second chance opportunity. And in Mitch's case, like, he's got so many different variable and combinations that he can use with his load, with his body formation. I had him when he was in London, and you know, a lot of the times when we were doing like one timer work with all the players, you know, like, you're engaging your hips, and if your hips aren't being engaged, like you said, with that build up of speed, then that player's not going to be able to take that shot. But it's not a selfish thing, and I think sometimes these guys, you know, they want to get that power out of their shot. They want to show that that's a weapon that they have. Mm. So if they want to choose to use it, then they're going to use that weapon. The more weapons they have, the better it is for them.
Tim, why, whether you would call this like a quick release snapper or something else, the shot that Austin Matthews and Alex Ovechkin seem to score so many goals on, particularly on the power play, why has that shot become so popular in the league?
Well, it's a bunch of different reasons. But one is the setup of that shot. When you're preparing to take that shot, a lot of times when you go to release a puck, you're doing it with chain reaction timing. You're synchronizing things. And second thing is, most of the time that shot, when it's taking the quick release combination of that toe drag inward, it's always coming in towards the body. So there's two common things. And then when you start changing that, when you start changing the timing of that stride leg release, you know, if you're a lefty, when you're releasing the puck, your left leg goes back. For righties, it's your right leg. When you start messing with that timing, it kind of freezes. It freezes the D, and then when the D freezes, there's the wall that's set up. Now, the goalie's vision's impaired. They've lost track of the puck. And then all of a sudden, they see it at the last second. And usually when you pull the puck inward, Rich, what happens is you can create more power and it's more deceptive. Mm. So your hands in front of your body are camouflaged. So it's kind of like dangling a carrot in front of a D, and then all of a sudden you stand the D up, change the angle of shot, you mess with the timing of your feet, they're unsure of when it's going to be released, and then by that time it's either hit the mesh or someone's jabbing in front because there's a rebound.
Hey, Tim, was great. No, go ahead. Sorry.
Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. It's great. Listen, this is great insight. Thank you so much for doing this. It was a terrific article. We've sent out a link to it, and thanks so much. I really enjoyed this.
Yeah, likewise, guys. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Tim.
Take care. Tim Turk, NHL shooting and scoring coach at Tim Turk Hockey. You can follow him on Twitter at Tim Turk Hockey. Sonny Satch David did the article. It's a fascinating look at the slapshot. I'm just going to read out some numbers, Richard, and I wanted to do that before we go. In 2018-2019, Brett Burns led the NHL in slap shots with 115. The Florida Panthers led 590 as a team. There were two players with more than 100 slap shots, and there were two teams with more than 500 slap shots. 2009-2010, so roughly 10 years earlier, 25 teams with more than 500 slap shots, 15 players with more than 100 slap shots. The league-leading slap shot total, 922 by the Chicago Blackhawks. So in 2009-2010, 922 by the Blackhawks compared to 590 for Florida. Duncan Keith had 163 slap shots that year compared to 115 for Burns, the leader in 2018-2019. Duncan Keith in the last 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years has led the league in slap shots five times. The single season leader in that time for slap shots, Dustin Byfuglien, had 195 in 2010, 2011. I'm sorry. But just think about that. 2018-2019, two teams with more than 500 slap shots, two players with more than 500 slap shots compared to 15 players 10 years earlier.
Yeah.
And 25. That just shows you how the game has changed.
Yeah, first of all, impressive that they keep these stats. That's actually very cool just to have that data. But, I mean, that is a dramatic change, Jeff, just in terms of the sheer number of slap shots that have dropped. Tim Turk, it's a real ability, Jeff, to sort of be able to describe the biomechanics of how this comes about. And, you know, I don't know if there, I think given my assessment of listening to Tim, I don't think there's going to be a renaissance per se of this shot. Although a lot of times, Jeff, you know, like sort of, if you're thinking about inefficiencies, if someone is not doing something in the game, a lot of times the reason to do that is it gives you an advantage.
The problem is if you take a slap shot and miss, it can be the most inefficient play in the sport.
Right, because if it gets blocked, and
if you miss the net, it ends up going down the ice.
Right.
You know, you've got an opportunity for the other team. Pete Caldera is a Yankees beat writer with a Bergen Record in USA Today Network. He's also a fine singer. He was on the Colbert Show, which was a late night. Late show.
Late show.
With Stephen Colbert. How can you tell that I'm...
You can't make it up anymore?
Tell that I'm in Netflix, dude. The Late Show. Stephen Colbert. Pete Caldera will join us. It's Writer's Block on 360 and 590.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
So Lost in Love. Not the name of this song? All Out of Love. But part of it is, I'm so lost in love, I can't live without you. Yeah, it's Air Supply. Air Supply was, this is solid. This is Jen's guilty play. I'm not going to bother submitting mine. But this is solid stuff. Although I wouldn't listen to this at any point.
No, I would never listen to this
Air
song.
Supply.
No, you know what, no disrespect to Jen.
You know what's great about Air Supply is always on. You remember those Time Life collections of
like the 70s?
The 70s
Karen
and all that.
Carpenter. Yeah.
They'd always interview the Air Supply guys on. It was tremendous. And I used to watch that on a loop over and over and over again when I was on the road because I had no life, basically. You know? So, Travis, did you just say Stephen Colbert is there? You did. Thank you for that.
I said Pete Caldera is there.
Anyhow. So there you go. Pete Caldera is a Yankees beat writer at the Bergen Record in the USA Today Network. But today, oh, we don't give a rat's ass about that title. Not at all. Pete Caldera joining Richard Deitch and myself in Writer's Block. I got to set this up, Pete. We got to talk. First of all, before I get to the whole Stephen Colbert, how that came about, when did you start running marathons, dude? You finished the New York City Marathon. When did that come about?
I was one and done. That's it. This is my first and probably last. I'm sure of it. No, I've been running for a while. You know, okay. Wally Matthews, right?
Yeah.
He when he was on the Yankees beat at ESPN, he was a runner, and he kind of got me into running, and that's how it started. So.
Okay. Well, anyhow, we'll discuss that later. This was now. I'll set this up for those of you who follow political things south the border. Donald Trump is no longer a resident of New York. He is a resident of Florida, which is just another reason to like Florida, right? Anyhow, Donald Trump is now a resident of Florida. So the Late Show with Stephen Colbert decided that they were going to celebrate this fact, and they couldn't get Sinatra, clearly. But they could somehow, the thought was, how do we go about, if we can't get Sinatra, who can we get? Well, they decided on Pete Caldera. This is what it sounded like. We're going to play it for our audience, and those of you in 360 are going to be able to see this as well, courtesy of our friends at CBS and Global. And Pete, we'll talk to you after we enlighten the viewership and the listenership. Derek, have at it.
Start spreading the news. Trump's leaving today. Tell the fake news. He's longing to stray, just like he's done on every wife. Uno, dos, and tres. I want to wake up in a city without a Trump. His W-2s are holding the clues of all the sleazy deals he's cut in old New York. Trump's time now. Here is done. I hope he takes his son.
Okay, Caldera, as I said, that I sent out a challenge to Shinen, Dave Shinen. You just raised the bar for Shinen. First of all, how did you keep a straight face doing that? How on earth did you keep a straight face?
Because that was about the sixth take. So.
Oh, okay. Well,
by then, we did that. That was not done in front of a live audience. That was taped several hours before the Colbert Show began. And so that was done on the stage, but there was no audience there.
Wow.
His writers are brilliant, and that was all they're doing. And there were a couple of revisions that were sent down while we were waiting and sort of rehearsing it with his terrific orchestra. And that's how it originated. So it was a lot of fun to do, really.
How did you get hooked up with him?
I got a cold call on my couch. You know, I had, right, as you said, I ran the marathon on Sunday, and I was a mess on Monday morning. So I was really on my couch, half asleep, about to get put ice on my knees. And my phone rang, and it was a phone number I didn't recognize. And that's usually the phone numbers I ignore.
Of
but
course,
I,
yeah.
I guess in my half my half somnambulant state, I picked it up, and it was somebody from the Colbert Show. Well, they had originally asked for. Now I sing at the Carnegie Club once a month. We do the standards: Tony mm-hmm. Bennett, Sinatra, Bobby Darin, all that kind of stuff. When I'm home, you know, if I get a Friday night off from the beat. But I also fill in on certain Saturdays if I can do it for the main guy who does the Sinatra Saturday show. His name is Stephen Maglio. And they originally called him because obviously he's associated with Sinatra here in New York, and that Sinatra show here in New York. I'm just his backup. So they called Stephen, and Stephen couldn't do it, but he gave the Colbert producer my number. And they phoned me and, are you doing anything? And I was on the couch. So, no, I'm not doing anything. The hardest thing was getting down to the subway, walking like Frankenstein through the streets of New York just to get to the Ed Sullivan studio.
Wow.
First, Pete, thank you for not sticking to sports. We appreciate that.
Yeah, we try to be well-rounded around here. Right?
Secondly, one of the things that strikes me as what would be a real challenge is, how hard is it to sing lyrics that are not known lyrics? You know, the Colbert writers are creating this that day or the day before, creating it for you, but you got to read that, right, and then try to figure out how it's going to sound, how it matches up with the instrumental. How'd you pull that off?
With a great orchestra and great writers, and with the help of a teleprompter that was aimed right at me, you know, so that was I didn't have to memorize anything. That was so easy, that part. If you know the melody and you sang it a million times, it seems like, you know, at the club, it's the song we end the night with, and it's been around for 40 years. You know instinctively where the accents are and where they're trying to hit the punchlines. And listen, I think we took to it pretty quickly. It was fun to do once we got it, down musically. I think it came together pretty fast, and it was, you knew what they were trying to do. And, it was just fun to sing those lyrics and be part of a comedy ensemble like that and do a parody. That was wonderful.
Everybody has a favorite Sinatra song. We all do. But how did you turn that from, I like Sinatra, the songs are fun, to actually, having moonlighting? I mean, you're moonlighting as a Sinatra singer. How did that come about? Like, when did it start? I know you used to do it in spring training, right? Am I not mistaken?
Yeah, that's kind of really where it did start, in Tampa at the – well, I first was – my first baseball experience was covering, a Yankee spring training for another newspaper. And there's a piano bar that's still there in Tampa, at Donatello. And the wonderful lady who plays the piano there, Miss Kitty, is still there. She's a wonderful musician. She's a top-tier musician. And she is so kind to – singers and can play any song in any key and knows every lyric. If you stumble, she can throw it at you. And that's kind of where I got a little confidence in singing and people liking it and thinking, well, maybe this is something that, I can do, as a sidelight from what pays the mortgage. Mm-hmm. And then when I got to the Mets beat, Bobby Valentine was the manager, and he introduced me to, oddly enough, Jilly Rizzo's son, Willie Rizzo, who had a club at that time in Chicago. Now, Jilly Rizzo was Frank Sinatra's,
right,
best friend for probably the last 20 years of his life.
Right.
And lived out in Las Vegas and Palm Springs. So Bobby got me together with, because he knew I loved Sinatra and loved to sing, and he introduced me to Willie, and I sang in Willie's club in Chicago. And then Willie opened a club in New York, and I sang from there. And then, I got the backup job at the Carnegie Club doing the Sinatra stuff. And then they called me to do once a month, during the year. And that's really what we've been doing. So it's been a lot of fun.
Pete, what has been the most interesting reaction that you have heard to your work on Colbert?
I'm floored by all the positive comments, really. It's I'm trying not to really people are directing me to these things, and I really just wanted to kind of keep it separate, and I didn't promote this, and I didn't want to promote it beforehand. I just wanted it to go and just let people hear it and react to it and see what they think of it. I've just been floored by the nice things, and hearing from people I hadn't heard from in a while, people in my life that are
have been very important to me, you know, reaching out and saying, you know, nice job. And we've been watching it a few times and, you know, got a laugh, and we loved it and loved the band, and the writing was sensational. So obviously that and that whole Colbert staff was wonderful. Really, the 3 to 4 hours I spent there with them, they could not have been more nicer to a real showbiz nobody than to treat me so well and you know, kind of be part of their ensemble for a couple hours. It was a lot of fun.
You know, one of the things that I think we've all noticed covering sports, Pete, is that the number of athletes who wish they could sing or play in a band is almost equal to the number of singers or dudes who or women who play in a band who wish they were athletes. What's the commonality there, do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. I think in the athletes realm, I think, you know, I'm always amazed at, you know, these professional athletes who are so good at what they do and can, you know, play at all-star caliber and make a lot of money doing what they do. And yet they're proficient at other sports. Now look at a guy, just as an example, like an Aaron Hicks with the Yankees. You know, he's on the cusp, if he could stay healthy, of being an all-star player. But if you took him away from a baseball field and put a golf club in his hand, he's a scratch golfer. He could be playing on the PGA Tour right now. Plus, you know, I'm guessing he could probably be an NFL football player too, mm-hmm. if he really wanted to be. Just amazed by Didi Gregorius, another guy, whose interests are so wide ranging, and not only is he an all-star caliber and Gold Glove caliber shortstop, but you know, he acts, he sings, he taught himself how to play the piano.
Wow.
While he was recovering from Tommy John surgery, which prompted. I wish I could say this is an original, and I apologize to the person who said this originally. It might have been Jaffe, who said, I thought he had Tommy John surgery, not Elton John surgery. But these guys are brilliant at what they can do. But yeah, you're right. I think a lot of guys would, yeah, maybe they would say, yeah, I'd love to trade it to be a rap star or a rock star or something like that. But, I just think it goes hand in hand with the lives they live and, you know, the circles they run in and the interests they have.
Pete, if I could be your showbiz genie and grant you one wish of you being able to play any place in the world, what would it be?
Well, I'm lucky enough to live in the greatest city in the world, I think, in New York. So I am sort of living it out right now where I am. But, you know, we were in London and Paris. London, I sort of took the tunnel to Paris while before the Yankee series began there against the Red Sox in June. And, I'd love to play in any one of those cities. What I'd really love to do is, in 1962, Frank Sinatra went on a world tour with a small band, 5 musicians. And I would love to recreate that, go from city to city and do that kind of music, you know, all over the place, all over Europe and a lot of the big cities. If I could have, one showbiz genie wish, I'd love to recreate that 1962 world tour Sinatra did with a small orchestra.
If you do it and you need a roadie. I'm still young enough that I can
on GoFundMe right now. Let's do it.
I'm still young enough that I can lift stuff.
You're hired.
Yeah. Hey, Pete, listen, thank you so much for joining us. Congratulations. It was really well done. It was loads of fun. I'm really happy for you, man. Thanks for doing this.
Really appreciate that, Jeff. Thank you so much. It was a blast to do.
All right. Take care.
Great job, Pete.
Pete Caldera, the Bergen Record, who, by the way, is a terrific writer. He is, I cannot tell you, to be on the Yankees beat for a long time.
Oh, yeah, competitive as hell.
George King, God, all those guys that have been in the beat
Joel
for
Sherman,
a long time.
Yeah.
Joel Sherman,
Bob Clappish.
The day-to-day stuff, though, like George and Peter, the guy, they do the day-to-day stuff. Like, they're doing the, you know, Aaron Boone has dropped Didi Gregorius down to the sixth spot today. the nuts and bolts day to day stuff. And I'm really happy for Pete. He's a terrific guy. We have him on the show as often as we can. He's a terrific writer, great reporter, and
what a talented guy.
Yeah,
man.
I'll tell you, one of my favorite moments was covering the Baltimore Orioles played an exhibition game in Cuba against the Cubans. And this would be, I want to say, 1997, maybe a bit later than that. And I covered it for the Globe and Mail. And it was the first time that a American baseball team had gone over to Cuba since, you know, they used to, teams would conduct spring training there. As partly, I mean, the Dodgers are one of the teams that did it as a way around the color barrier, because there was a color barrier in the States, there wasn't a Florida, in Cuba anyhow. So this was a big thing. It was a cultural exchange program. You've never lived, by the way, until you've gone through U.S. Customs with Woody Harrelson in front of you, which is what happened to me. He was part of this group. Anyhow, we went to this. I'd gone to Cuba on a vacation. I'd gone to Havana vacation two times before, and I'd found this neat restaurant in Havana, and this great old piano player. And he'd play anything. So because I'd been down there, I was sort of tasked with the idea of organizing dinner in Cuba for about eight baseball writers. One of them was Bill Madden, legendary New York Daily News writer. And by the way, a guy who is almost as much of a Sinatra aficionado as Caldera. So we went to this place, great meal. And I didn't tell him anything about the piano player. The piano player is noodling away. The piano player also knew English, so I went up to him and explained where we're from. This is a newspaper writer, a fairly well-known newspaper writer from New York. The dude ripped through Sinatra's playlist. Bill Madden, crusty old Bill Madden, started to cry.
Wow.
As he was having dinner. He started to cry because this guy was so good. And it was a cool moment. It was a cool moment. And a little bit of baseball, a little bit of Sinatra there as well. We'll take a break and come back. And Deitch is going to sing. Deitch is going to rap for us. Deitch is going to rap for us when we come back. It's Writer's Block.
Some Public Enemy coming up after the
Public Enemy on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and 360. Finishing out her guilty pleasures list. Crocodile Rock by Elton John.
Very good one.
I'm just not.
Game over, man. This is like Vince Carter dunking and doing the hand sign.
I feel like I've been Garrett Cole.
Well, it sucks for you because you have to go tomorrow. I'd rather be Brandeo.
Oh, didn't I tell you? Brandeo's going tomorrow.
Never want to follow the guy. Yeah. Or the girl in this case.
Yeah. No. Anyhow, that's I'll attempt.
Crocodile Rock's a really good one though, because like if that's playing in a car, you will leave it on.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
But I feel like Elton John's got a ton of those. His playlist. He and Billy Joel have a crazy amount of hits during their careers.
Yes. Anyhow, there you go.
Philadelphia over. Freedom for me is one I always leave on. For Elton, I like that song.
Philadelphia Freedom. It's not bad. Candle in the Wind is one.
Oh, that's
Elton
good.
Elton John's
well,
song.
Newer.
Candle in the Wind.
Boy, that Pete Caldera guy is talented as hell.
We'll get him in studio.
I feel like I should profile him. He's a really good story.
He said, we'll get him in studio when the Yankees are in town next year if we're still doing this. we'll get him in studio.
Yeah. No, super talented.
He will do it. He will definitely do it. He'll come in. He works for, he works for beer too, which is the other thing
always
I like about
nice.
Caldera.
Always nice.
Anyhow.
Are you staying up for Bucks Clippers tonight at 10? You going to check out the first half of that?
No.
I will.
Yes. I'm going to watch the whole thing. It's on Sports. And I will be
on,
up.
Jeff.
I'll watch the whole
thing. I gave you a setup.
I'm actually going to the Raptors game tonight.
Oh,
so
nice.
I'll be listening to it on the way home, and then I will watch it as soon as I get home. First thing I'll do is I'll have some peanut butter and toast and tea, and I will watch. Who is it? I'll watch Bucks and Clippers.
You know, the Kings were expected to be a much better team than they've been. I'll be curious to see how the Raptors handle that tonight. Should be a win.
Yeah, whatever happened, they were the up-and-coming team next year, right?
Remember, Luke Walton, by the way, coaching that team, yeah, right? He's been a mess.
Travis, they rolled into town, and Buddy Hield. But yeah, they came into town with, they have Darren Fox and all that last year. Everybody was talking about how they were going to be like,
no, they're kind of one of the next it team. Yeah. It hasn't happened.
No.
Yeah, we'll see. But they have a lot of talent, and, you know, it's not a team that you can take lightly, but it should be a win for the Raps.
Yeah, and this is the last home game the Raps go to in a while. The Raps go to New Orleans, Portland. Portland not necessarily playing all that well right now, but it's still Portland. They go to New Orleans, Portland, two games against the L.A. teams, and then on to Dallas. And, I after what you were talking about yesterday, I just kind of glanced at some of the Mavericks, the stuff on the Mavericks. They are much better than I thought they'd
be. Well, Porzingis is healthy, and, you know, he is one of these players, Jeff, that, like, I remember him in New York when he was really at his best. He's an impossible guard. He's a 7'3 guy who could hit three-pointers. Like, you can't guard that guy.
If I'm not mistaken, when the NBA All-Star game was in Toronto and the Futures game, or whatever the hell they called it.
Yeah, yeah.
The Friday night
like
before.
The rookie versus ops.
I think it was Porzingis. I think Porzingis and Karl Anthony Towns both played. Karl Anthony Towns went off. Karl Anthony
that
Towns
guy I thought was going to be.
Was great.
Yeah, I mean, he's good, but he's not as good as I thought he was going to be. He's still young. It could happen.
There's something about, and I truly believe this. I don't know what it is about the franchise, but to me, Minnesota is like a lot of those franchises where guys' careers go to stagnate.
I agree. Except for Garnett. But everyone, J.R. Ryder, Steph Marbury, there's a ton of them.
Travis?
Andrew
Minnesota's
Wiggins.
Off to a good start this season. Yeah. Towns has been fantastic.
Yeah, but in the past, it's kind of been like Andrew Wiggins has kind of spun his wheels there. Last year wasn't a great year
Ricky
for
Ricky Rubio?
You know, they fired my boy, Tom Thibodeau, one of the... Thibodeau's pregame interviews are great.
Great coach, but seems to maybe eventually wear on players who can't handle.
A bit of a nutbar, I think, yeah.
Yeah. I love the Jimmy Butler, Tom Thibodeau dynamic, though.
Oh, that was tremendous. Yeah. But anyhow, so the Kings tonight, and we'll see. This will be, again, no Patrick McCaw, at least for a month, than a month.
Got to get a win tonight, because the road trip's going to be hell. These are games you have to have, to me. I know it's early, but you got to win.
Yeah, I will be interested in seeing the distribution of labor with Fred VanVleet and Kyle Lowry. And
you can stick around for postgame, the Knicks conference and that stuff?
Yes.
Okay.
I'll be interested in seeing how they split the labor up, especially with the road trip coming up. I just think that Kyle Lowry's minutes are just complete, to me right now, are completely, completely unsustainable.
Oh,
they really are.
No chance.
They really are.
No, yeah. I mean, I think Nurse... And his coaches, they know that, but
they,
you know, it's a problem, Jeff. It's like, I don't know if he has the faith yet that he can win without him putting those minutes in. That's what's scary. They need to find some depth. Nick Nurse is going to have to invest in some of these guys on the bench and just give it a shot.
Absolutely.
It's not sustainable.
And let's see tonight if we start seeing Pascal Siakam do a little more of the ball handling responsibilities again. That's something, as our friend Hubie Brooks talked about when the Raptors were playing Cleveland in the playoffs. It's kind of the move now. The move is to have your best player have the ball in his hands as often as he possibly can and trust his vision. So it's one of the LeBron's biggest strengths. It appears as if we're moving irrevocably towards Pascal Siakam fulfilling that role as well. It's going to put more pressure on him when it comes to dealing with officials and fouls. That's it for us. Tim and Sid are next. Mike Babcock joins Tim and Sid. Have a great night.